Hi, comrades. So I'm speaking to you all from stolen Wurundjeri land here in Naarm in Melbourne, and just want to acknowledge the traditional owners, both past, present and emerging, and any Aboriginal people here tonight, and acknowledge that this land, you know, was never ceded and the struggle continues today, and we stand in solidarity with you in those struggles. So I'm going to be talking about nuclear power, why it's not safe and not the answer to climate change. When I was thinking about this talk, I realised I actually did a talk about this in 2006 at one of the ISO's conferences. And the reason that I did a talk on it was because John Howard was talking about this issue and talking about nuclear. And again, the same idea that it could be some sort of solution to climate change was put on the table. And they even did a... They even did an inquiry into it, an official inquiry into the nuclear industry. And I think a lot of the reasons that Howard pursued it back then are still relevant today, and I'll get into that. So just a little bit of context on you know, what's behind this. So, you know, we've got the COP26 climate talks in Glasgow at the moment, where Morrison is spruiking the Australian way. He's refusing to set emission targets for 2030. He's refused to sign onto any sort of methane reduction pledges, and continuing to spruik technologies that are, you know, mythical, and while continuing to expand the fossil fuel industry and our emissions. And at the same time, you know, just in the last month, we've seen the AUKUS nuclear subs deal, which Australia has pursued with the US and the UK, so that we can actually get our hands on nuclear subs and basically, you know, as part of our ramping up the China threat and aggression in and posturing in our region. So that's sort of the setting in which, you know, we see this nuclear industry raise its head yet again and pose itself as some sort of option, or, you know, clean, green, safe option in the climate catastrophe. You know, so we are facing a code red for climate, it has been called. We need a massive transformation in energy production, and we need it immediately. We have to cut the emissions at least 50% below 2005 levels by 2030, probably at least by 75%. If we want to limit temperature rises to less than 1.5. And yet, you know, as the Glasgow summit is underway, we are on track to overshoot to 2.7 degrees. So the nuclear proponents are arguing, you know, that we must have all energy options available, that, you know, it must be part of the solution, must be part of the energy mix. Now, it's interesting if you look at who is pushing the discussion now. It no longer is it sort of prominent environmentalists, which you definitely saw in the sort of the 2000s, where you saw George Monbiot, you saw James Lovelock, and locally you even saw Bob Carr, you know, saying we've got to talk about nuclear. Now they're not talking about it. It's, you know, it's only the very marginal who are actually putting this as a solution, or people that have vested interests, whether they be states or the industry itself. So now you have, you know, people like ASPI, the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, which is a right-wing think tank that's been pushing it hard. You've got BHP, you've got the Mineral Council of Australia, you've got Matt Canavan, you've got Angus Taylor. All these people, a lot of them are actually champions of, you know, coal, oil and gas. So I guess the idea there is, if nuclear energy was actually going to displace these industries, why would these people be actually championing or talking about it at all? Also, more globally, you've got the nuclear industry trying to push for legitimacy. They know that they're very much on the margins, and they're trying to push for some space within the energy mix as it's changing. So they've been pushing the European Parliament to be recognised as a green energy and to be able to access, you know, sustainability funding, etc. And they have been pushed out of the COP26 and blocked from attending, but, you know, they're still there in massive numbers with their PR still trying to push it onto states as a solution. So now I'm going to get into, you know, the actual nitty gritty of this so-called nuclear solution. Is it clean, green and safe? So nuclear power, they run on uranium. So it's when the nucleus of a uranium molecule is split inside a reactor, heat is produced. This process is called nuclear fission, and the heat produced from this process is used to create steam from water, and the steam drives the turbines that power generators. And this is what creates electricity. It is not green, and it's definitely not zero emissions. Unlike coal and gas, obviously, there's no greenhouse gases produced in the actual operation of the nuclear reactor, but of course, all the other steps involved in producing nuclear power, from mining to construction, decommissioning and waste management, result in greenhouse gas pollution. In fact, you know, ironically, like the Olympic Dam uranium mine in South Australia itself is one of the biggest producers of carbon dioxide, consuming, this is an old figure, but it used to consume about a quarter of the electricity that was used in South Australia. So next thing is it safe? You know, what are the health implications and for the environment? And I guess the nuclear lobby strategy has actually been to totally minimize and or just outright deny health environmental consequences of nuclear radiation. They point to the Fukushima disaster and the fact that there's been, you know, few radiation-induced cancers identified yet, despite the, you know, that it's unlikely to be detected within 10 years at a population level. They also, you know, say that radiation is natural, that bananas have radiation, absolutely criminal misinformation. There's no argument that nuclear radiation is deadly. Exposure to ionizing radiation, which happens at virtually every stage of the nuclear fuel cycle, is a health hazard. You know, the weight of scientific opinion says that there is no threshold below which ionizing radiation poses no risk to inducing fatal cancers. And this is called the linear no threshold theory. So radiation protection agencies around the world, including the Australian Radiation Protection Nuclear Safety Agency, all base regulations on the linear no threshold model, which assumes that there is no threshold below which radiation exposure is safe. So even at very low doses, you know, there's an increased risk of cancer and cardiovascular disease. Tens of thousands of people across Europe died from radiation-related cancers as a result of the Chernobyl disaster, estimates as high as 93,000. The International Atomic Energy Agency estimates of total exposure gives an estimated 30,000 cancer deaths from that disaster. There is also well-established links between uranium mining and lung cancer. The National Research Councils, they did a big, I guess, a whole lot of research into this and did a report recently, the Bear 6, and found increasingly frequency of lung cancer uranium miners, which was directly proportional to the cumulative amount of radon the miners had been exposed to. And in terms of environmentally, you know, uranium mining is not safe. All mines have history of leaks, spills and accidents. And the Australian Senate, which investigated this in 2003, found that the uranium mining sector is characterised by a pattern of underperformance and non-compliance, an absence of reliable data to measure the extent of contamination, its impact on the environment. And so we're not even talking about once it gets to the nuclear power plant. one thing that's coming out recently and is very worrying for people across the world is that nuclear power plants are incredibly vulnerable to the threats which are being exacerbated by climate change. So, you know, these include dwindling and warming water sources, sea level rise, storm damage, drought. You know, the Fukushima disaster itself is an example of this, where there was a combination of an earthquake and a tsunami, and both those events together meant, you know, the disaster occurred because there was a cut in power and there was an inability to actually cool those reactors. So as we see more extreme weather events, we're going to see possibly more of these incidents occurring. And one a retired nuclear engineer, actually, David Lockman, stated you need to solve global warming for nuclear plants to actually survive. Now, if we get actually into the cost, one of the nuclear industry's favourite thing to say is to point to the rising energy electricity prices around the world and sort of offer themselves as an alternative, and that they're, you know, that they are a cheaper option. But actually, the nuclear energy industry is extremely, hugely expensive, much more expensive than the vast majority of other electricity technologies. It's inefficient, and it could not exist at all without government subsidies and massive state subsidies. Extremely expensive to build. For instance, the Hinkley Nuclear Power Station that's been taking a decade or so to build in the UK will cost £20 billion or about $36 billion Australian dollars. And it just cannot compete on a basis with wind and solar, which are the cheapest forms of new generation. And, you know, the cost of the energy from the Hinkley Power Station is significantly higher than large-scale solar, wind and offshore wind energy in the UK. Renewables keep coming in price, keep coming down in price, but it is nuclear. It's the only energy source that keeps getting more and more expensive over time. Even the World Nuclear Industry Status Report, which is an independent body, it says that states that new nuclear energy is simply not competitive under ordinary market economy rules anywhere. And in Australia, it would be even more expensive because we have to start from scratch. You know, you'd need to lift moratoriums. There'd need to be legislation drafted. You'd need to regulate mining, enrichment, energy, transportation and storage. Taxpayers will, you know, will pay to set up the industry. We would end up subsidising the reactors. The other huge cost of nuclear reactors is the safety requirements needed to avoid catastrophic situations like Chernobyl or Fukushima. So because meeting these requirements leads to, you know, multi-year construction blowouts. Even so, the risks associated to nuclear power stations mean they are essentially uninsurable. If the operators did have to insure against the full risk of nuclear accidents, the premiums would make the cost of nuclear power prohibitively uncompetitive. And so the only way that it can happen is if government actually fills in the gap with taxpayer dollars and they become the insurer. So the Fukushima disaster, it's estimated the total cost was actually over US$500 billion, but the actual power station was only insured for US$1.5 billion. So the actual, the Japanese state itself had to fill in the rest. So I think that's probably enough. Although, you know, one more thing, like the Citibank, they issued a report in 2009 and, you know, they don't tend to, you know, they've got little reason to actually cheer for the industry or not. They said the risk faced by developers of new nuclear plants is so large and variable that individually they could each bring even the largest utility company to its knees financially. So if we get back to emissions, does it actually do the job? If we did, you know, decide to go down that road. So we have to cut emissions fast, 50% below 2005 levels by 2030 and zero emissions by 2050. If we introduce nuclear power to Australia, and that included convincing the electorate, getting local and government, like populations, building infrastructure, et cetera, at the most, possibly it could be done in 15 years, but it's more likely around a quarter of a century. And this is only assuming as well that nuclear power replaced fossil fuels. This would actually only even reduce emissions by just 5%. So it's way too late in any case. There's no role for nuclear power in actually supplanting coal and coal, oil or gas. And, you know, when you actually look at the time to assist the rapid, you know, the actual electricity transition needed for climate mitigation is just not there. And by the time that these things are built, we'd have 100% renewable energy. So it's just, it's not even an option. It's also additionally not even renewable. So, for instance, if nuclear power was expanded to half the world's current energy supplier, known high-grade uranium ores would last less than a decade. Now, one technology that has been spruiked, and even Angus Taylor specifically listed it, is as something that we should look into, is the small modular reactors or generation four reactors. They're meant to be, you know, an economical solution. They're smaller, they can be, they're more mobile, but just like carbon capture and storage, they're a mythical technology. There's no evidence that they work or even that they kind of exist outside sort of prototype models. But that doesn't mean we're not pursuing them. We've been paying the UK government a lot of money as well to look into how to develop the technology. So, okay. The another huge issue that I'm sure we're all aware of as well is the waste. And I guess aside from meltdowns, you know, radiation, sickness, cancers, the issue of waste is probably the most enduring. And even after 70 plus years that the industry has been in existence, they still have no safe solution for storing or disposing of nuclear waste. And nuclear waste is actually produced at every stage of the nuclear fuel cycle. And all of it is incredibly dangerous to human life, and it can cause leukemia as well as other cancers. And this is doesn't even talk about, you know, ecosystem damage if it's released into the environment. There's still no permanent or safe way to store waste. It needs to be isolated for hundreds of thousands of years, and it continues to be built up in storage facilities all over the world. There's not a single permanent repository exists anywhere in the world. And it's already left, the industry has already left a legacy of waste and pollution, which has massive cleanup costs. It is reaching a crisis point in many states, and Australia is not immune to this. For the last couple of decades, we've been actually a lot longer than that. The state Australia has been looking for a way to dispose of the waste that's produced at Lucas Heights, which is a very small reactor, and you know we've had campaigns to prevent them using Aboriginal land in the desert, whether it was at Muckaty Station, and now they're talking about building one at Nampundi in SA near Pimba. Now, the other important thing to think about when you talk about nuclear energy is where it's come from, and I guess it's inextricable link to nuclear weapons development. So nuclear energy was actually born out of the nuclear weapons industry, and they remain linked. So nuclear power programs provided cover for numerous covert weapons programs, and an expansion of nuclear power would exacerbate the problems and, of course, lead to proliferation. To establish itself, the nuclear industry realised that they did need a peaceful cover. So, you know, they needed some sort of way to continue to be able to legitimately develop the technology and perfect, you know, their weapons of mass destruction. So they couldn't do that by, you know, being explicit about that. So using it as energy was a perfect cover. Moreover, the plutonium that's used in fusion-based hydrogen bombs is not an element that occurs naturally on Earth. And so it's a byproduct of fission, splitting uranium atoms to unleash and harness energy, which take place inside nuclear reactors. Hence, without a nuclear power program, presented as the peaceful generation of unlimited, cheap and safe energy, it's not possible to produce the required amount of plutonium for nuclear weapons. The technology and expertise required to operate a nuclear energy program provides many of the requirements for the construction of nuclear weapons. So Israel, India, Pakistan, South Africa, and possibly even North Korea have used civil nuclear energy programs to develop their own nuclear weapons. And the five declared nuclear weapon states, the US, UK, Russia, France, and China, all have civilian nuclear power facilities. It's the crossover is, you know, it's not exceptional, it's commonplace. So if nuclear power expanded globally, it would mean providing, you know, every country with nuclear power technology and our own ruling class with that technology. Another thing to think about with the development of nuclear power is that when you go down that road, any state that goes down that road is moving towards authoritarianism. They are forced to use authoritarian measures on their populations and I guess as state security. Because of the profound danger of the weapon development, they have to have highly centralized and secretive structures. They have to have, you know, security of the plants, security of the waste, have to have incredibly rigorous hazardous material regulations or lack of, and then, you know, suppress information on the leaks or safety breaches. There's an escalation of security forces. So it also has to be state sponsored and controlled, even if the profits are actually private. So you're getting a, you know, more centralized centralization of the state and the nuclear industry. And I guess, you know, at the other end of the things, nuclear weapons themselves, you know, are the ultimate, I guess, symbol of a lack of democracy in the system. You know, there's no checks and balances on who can push and or, you know, democratic decision making on who can push the button on a nuclear weapon. It's very, So I guess what I'd like to talk about now is why it is that nuclear energy is being pushed at this stage. And I'm going to have to wrap up because I'm a little bit over. So I'll just quickly go over a couple of things. So there's, first of all, and I think the main point is that it's, you know, nuclear is being pushed as a distraction, as a massive distraction from the real action that is needed to avert runaway climate change, you know, and the massive transformation that we need of the economy, industry and how society is run. It divides the climate movement, or at least it used to, hopefully not so much anymore. But, there is the argument, we should just be building everything. We need to look at all options. The climate emergency is that serious. The second thing we need to actually think about is that, you know, this is an opportunity for the Australian ruling class to start talking about nuclear weapons and to pursue their ambitions again, you know, and every opportunity they get, they will do so. The logic of capitalism leads all capitalists, even our local ones, towards military competition. And this wouldn't be the first time. Our state has pursued several times over the last century to get weapons. We saw that in the 1960s, they actually even started building a secret nuclear reactor in the south coast of New South Wales. We're seeing that with the AUKUS deal. And, you know, they will capitalize on the global geopolitical instability that we are seeing, not least of all because of climate catastrophe and climate, what's happening with the climate change, to assert our own imperial interests in the region. And the nuclear industry at any opportunity will actually also pursue that. And just third thing as well is uranium mining. We still sit on one of the biggest reserves in the world. We've got 40% of the reserves, and we've got about 13% of the global market. But the uranium mining industry, you know, it's on the margins because nuclear is on the nose after Fukushima, and the price has sunk. The uranium mining industry wants that back. It's not a coincidence the BHP vice president of sustainability and climate, Dr. Fiona Wild, suddenly is concerned about climate change and is talking about that we have to look at nuclear again. We have a number of mines that are still operating, and we've still got 10 more that they want to open up. But I'll just finish up with that, and just to say that, you know, nuclear is not safe. It's absolutely no solution. But importantly, they have never been able to establish an industry here. There's been decades of campaigning against uranium mining, against nuclear proliferation, for nuclear disarmament. And that's the reason that there's massive public opposition. So while, you know, capitalists cannot offer solutions, and we can see that clearly with COP23, they can offer us, you know, switching from one dangerous set of destructive industries to another. But it is us that, you know, we have to create the solutions. Thank you.